Welcome to the Society of Construction Law Australia podcast, the podcast where we look at legal and technical issues facing the Australian construction industry. My name's Melissa Yeo, and I'm chair of the Society's Communications Subcommittee. In this podcast, we bring you a recording of our recent event, which took place in Melbourne on 23 February 2023. Here, Ben McLeod, partner at Piper Alderman, talks about the decision in V601 and ProBuild, and provides insight into all the good stuff that makes construction law so interesting. Superintendent's duties, delay methodologies, acceleration, and more. This is really the good stuff. So we hope you enjoy this podcast. For updates as to the Society's events, including our upcoming conference in Uluru, please visit our website, scl.org.au. Thanks again for joining us.
Just to show you how long this dispute played out, you can see that practical completion occurred in December 2013. We didn't actually get judgment until December 2021. So around 8 years of dispute, both informal dispute before the proceedings commenced, and then around 5 to 6 years in the proceeding. But that wasn't the end of it either. V601 sought to appeal the findings of Justice Digby, and also made an application to seeking a stay on the payment of the judgment debt. Unfortunately for ProBuild, before that application was heard, ProBuild went into voluntary administration. V601, a couple of months later, lost its stay application and promptly essentially made itself up. So not a great advertisement for litigation, I suppose. Both parties have certainly come out losers. All right, so we'll talk now about the role of the superintendent. As we all know, construction contracts typically do require supers to act fairly, reasonably, and in good faith, that sort of language. In this part of the presentation, I'm going to go into quite a bit of detail around, firstly, why the superintendent, in this case, was found to have lost their independence, and secondly, the consequences that actually flow from that lack of independence, which I think has been, as I said before, not really picked up on yet. Firstly, we'll just go down memory lane and refresh ourselves about Kane and Sokov, a key passage from a really well-known case here in Victoria, where Chief Justice Warren set out the key indicia of when the superintendent's independence has or will have been interfered with. You can see them there. Firstly, where the super allows its judgment to be influenced or controlled. Secondly, where the super acts in the interests of one of the parties. Thirdly, where they act as a mediator. Happens quite commonly in my experience, that one. Fourthly, where they require the essential approval of the principal. And lastly, where they fail to give full disclosure of their dealings with the principal to the contractor as well. Now, I want to touch again on V601's LD's claim because it's going to become relevant. The basis upon which they put their claim will become relevant to how the judge dealt with it. So they claimed LDs for late completion, and they pleaded their claim entirely as a debt purely based on certificates that had been issued by the superintendent. I think there were five in total. But relevantly for our purposes, the LD's clause was an unamended version the relevant part was an unamended version of clause 34.7 of AS 4902, and it said that where ProBuild runs late, the project manager shall certify as due and payable to the principal liquidated damages. So I've highlighted that key phrase, shall certify. Now I'm going to go through with you the superintendent provision of this precinct contract. It was an amended version of clause 20, I think it's clause 20, but it did what often happens with the amendments, splits out the agency functions and the independent certifier functions, and in this case actually sort of spelt out in what circumstances is the super entitled to act as agent, and then there were some discrete categories where the super was required to act as independent certifier. So for agency, it's assessing the value of work, issuing payment certifications, directing variations, and making determinations as to quality. And it went on to say they have to act honestly, but they don't need to act impartially. Turning now to the independent certifier functions. As independent certifier, the super must act as independent certifier when assessing EOTs, assessing whether practical completion has been achieved, pricing variations and delay damages. And the clause went on to say that they must act reasonably, have regard to the express requirements of the contract, and ignore the party's commercial interests. That became very relevant later on. And they may consult with either party, but they're not obliged to consult with both. That was an argument raised by V601 to say, well, this is all okay because they're allowed to, the suitor's allowed to consult with one party. There's nothing really to see here. Huge dispute about discovery, I mentioned. Essentially, V601 tried to withhold production of the superintendent's file on the basis that the documents were privileged, arguing that they were essentially documents in respect of the super's agency function and not in respect of their role as independent certifier. But it was one of those cases where you are having a fight about discovery and then you receive the documents and you're quite pleased you have that fight. In the result, Probal gave 33 examples of the superintendent's lack of independence, and essentially the judge upheld all of them. He focused on only a few of them in the judgment, but he sort of made a passing reference to say, and I agree with the rest of them. Much of the trial focused on the cross-examination of the superintendent and how he went about assessing claims, and it really just showed that the super really didn't have any comprehension of his role and was just very readily influenced by V601. V601 didn't really engage with this part of the trial. In my view, they sought to minimise the issue by essentially saying, well, it doesn't really matter because we agree that the claims are reviewable by the court, so we can all just move on from dealing with whether the suitor was independent or not and move on to the expert evidence, essentially. But the judge was fairly scathing in his assessment, found that the super lacked independence, that V601 breached the contract, and therefore that the LD certificates that the super had provided and on which V601 relied should be set aside. And so because those certificates were set aside, there was nothing for V601 to rely on, and the entire claim for LDs fell away. So I may regret saying this, but to my knowledge, this is the first time an LD certificate has been set aside in this way, and a claim for LDs based purely on a superintendent certification, where they failed to act independently. So this was a major takeout for me. Some of the categories, I won't go through all 33 examples, but some of the key categories of where the super was interfered with and lost their independence, I'll go through now. The first was the super proposed during the project, they were trying to renegotiate their deal, they thought it appropriate to propose being paid on a profit share basis on the development in circumstances where they were required to act independently and assess claims independently. Secondly, the second point here was the one really focused on by the judge. The super was found to have colluded with V601 to devise and implement strategies and tactics which would advantage V601 and minimise Probal's entitlements. That strategy was quite plain from the discovery, from the file notes of meetings and phone calls. There was sort of almost a transcript of who said what. Drafts of documents were routinely circulated amongst the team from the super to V601 to its solicitors, who were all sort of commenting on what the documents should say before they were sent back to Probal. One key pillar of the strategy I want to mention was the superintendent engaged an expert programmer to assist in what he called defence preparation. That expert was engaged to prepare what was called a mitigation measures paper. Essentially, it was a document which would provide suggestions on how to find efficiencies in Probal's program and their construction methodology, so they could finish quicker if you just made these tweaks to the program. The overall objective was to reduce Probal's entitlements, and V601 originally claimed privilege over all of that information. Another part of the strategy was essentially the superintendent issuing usually draft bogus determinations containing incorrect information about the super's final determination. There was one really key piece of cross-examination which happened where the document flow showed that the superintendent issued a draft to V601 who demanded that the dates change, that the adjusted dates for practical completion in the EOTs. The superintendent then changes the dates and sends it back to V601 for final approval, but he then admitted under cross-examination that he didn't agree with those dates. And that assessment, funnily enough, also purported to bring forward some of the dates for practical completion for some of these several proportions. So a whole litany of sort of errors going on there. But that was a really key piece of chronology, sort of showing how the superintendent was being used by V601 to, the idea was the super would issue a lowball determination, V601 would then come in and say, hey, would you like to cut a deal? Let's try and resolve this on a much, on a favourable basis for V601. There was also advice from V601 solicitors to conceal certain documents from ProBuild and not hand them over. So that was another part of it. Another very funny, if I say funny, but another very interesting part of the cross-examination was the super thought it appropriate after ProBuild raised allegations of lack of independence, essentially forwarded the letter on to V601 solicitors for advice. So that was sort of just showing that he really didn't understand his role to act independently. Turning now to V601's conduct as opposed to, or specifically rather than the superintendent, the judge found that V601 sought to performance manage or basically strong arm the superintendent into getting an outcome that they wanted. That included V601 at a very critical time when lots of claims hadn't been assessed yet by the super. V601 issued the superintendent under the project management agreement with a show cause notice, accusing them of failing to do their job properly and the usual stuff included in a show cause, I suppose. V601 also turned the financial tap off the superintendent at that time, withheld months and months of payment from the superintendent, essentially, again, with a view to trying to get a favourable assessment of its claims. And lastly, the last example of this element, V601 was at pains to remind the superintendent that the financier, was worried, they were refusing further drawdowns, and that V601 was going to have to fund whatever the entitlement was. One of the file notes said something to the effect of Salvo or V601 doesn't have the money to step up for ProBuild's claim, and this is a concern. Other elements here, so that the super obtained expert advice, this is the expert evidence I was referring to before, obtained that expert advice and just uncritically adopted it. Again, relatedly, the super made a determination without regard to a proper delay analysis. So again, relying on this expert advice, which was not really a delay analysis at all, not really directed to whether ProBuild was mitigating the delay, but just how could we potentially improve the program? Quite a different question. And last but not least, the superintendent was prejudging claims. So an example was before a variation claim was even submitted. The super wrote to V601 and said, I'm going to use every section of the drawings and the specification to reject this claim. I haven't never received a claim yet. The major lesson learned here is about the certification process of LDs by the superintendent. We often see that clause amended such that LDs become automatically a debt due and payable rather than needing some sort of a certification by the super to crystallise a debt under the contract. And I think this case is why we make that amendment, essentially. It's a reminder to me, it sort of shows the link or the risks of linking an LD's entitlement to the superintendent certification process, which has to be done independently and reasonably and fairly. In this case, as I said, the claim was pleaded entirely as a debt and there was no alternative claim. Maybe there could have been, I'm not sure. Maybe you could make a general damages claim in this situation, but that wasn't done. So there was nothing left for V601 to fall back on, and the entire claim sort of evaporated. But I think it's at least arguable that where the super fails to certify LDs at all, and that's something I've come across quite a bit, supers are sort of reluctant to certify LDs and sort of hope the parties just resolve it, and then the project runs its course and they become funders officio and they can no longer do it. So where that happens, or where the super issues a certificate, but that certificate is tainted by a lack of independence, to me, there's a reasonable argument to say, well, the principal's LD's claim, or the principal has no LD's claim. So that's my meaty takeaway from today. The other points on this slide, stuff which we should probably already know, but really, drilling into our clients to understand the dividing line between independence and agency. So should you have separate meetings away from the superintendent? Being particularly careful during the really critical periods when the assessments haven't been made, that's another real takeaway from me. So a lot of the bad behaviour occurred while the claims were being assessed. And lastly, consider whether the super should get separate legal advice. I'll go on and talk now about the acceleration claim, which is sort of linked to the independence function of the super. So most of the articles that have been written about this case have focused on this being an example of a claim for constructive acceleration getting up, essentially a claim where there had been no direction to accelerate, but yet the contractor recovered its costs of accelerating. What in reality, this was actually the by far and away the least scrutinised claim that was dealt with in the court. Not much in the way of layer expert evidence at all to deal with it. So the acceleration claim was a claim for $1.8 million, and the claim was put on three alternative bases. But they were all predicated on the same premise. A claim for additional costs incurred as a result of the super's failure to award Probuild its full ERT entitlements, such that Probuild was compelled to accelerate the work in order to reduce or overcome the delays and attempt to finish by the unadjusted date for PC. So that's the sort of basic premise of what the claim was founded on. In terms of causes of action, how it was pleaded in three ways. The first way was essentially a claim for mitigation costs arising out of V61's breaches of the contract and the superintendent's failure to award its ERT entitlements. Secondly, and you could almost put them in the same as part of the same claim, but it was a claim for Probuild's loss and damage, so it's purely loss and damage flowing from the super's failure to act independently. And lastly, what was pleaded was that the rejections of the claim by the superintendent constituted a direction to accelerate under the acceleration regime. In this contract, the definition of direction was quite broad. It encompassed the word rejection, so that was relied on by Probuild to say the rejection of a claim means a direction under the acceleration regime. In terms of V61's defence, they didn't really engage much with this claim other than to defend the third one. That they said, look, there's been no direction to accelerate, therefore there's no entitlement under the acceleration regime, and otherwise made some criticisms of Probuild's evidence but didn't really put on its own evidence in reply. So here's just a very brief snapshot of Probuild's evidence. I thought it might be helpful just to sort of spell out just a little bit how the claim was put in case that's useful. So some of the evidence, the lay evidence that was put on by Probuild related to these four categories in red here. The first category, there was evidence from our project manager that there had been additional staff and labour that needed to be brought onto the project in order to manage the activities that had been delayed and also to increase productivity. The labour hire was a little bit easier to isolate in terms of costs because it mostly came from labour hire. So acceleration claims are fairly difficult to sort of unravel what is the additional cost and what is just a cost of doing the work generally, but the labour hire was helpfully a bit easier in that regard. Secondly, Probuild took a step to rent a second factory to increase the production of the glazing which had been delayed. Also, in respect of the glazing delay, Probuild entered into agreements, very short form agreements, agreeing to pay the glazing subcontractor to go faster. If you finish by this date, I'll give you a bonus, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Lastly, Probuild made a claim in relation to having to move its site sheds and other amenities, which were situated where the works were planned to finish last, but eventually, because they accelerated, that was where the works were going to finish first, so they had to move their site sheds as a consequence. And that was all recoverable, found to be recoverable, I think, by Justice Digby. Not much in the way of expert evidence. In terms of quantum evidence, all the expert was asked to decide was, are these the types of costs that would typically be incurred during acceleration? And our expert said yes. That was really the extent of our claim. In terms of the court's findings, the court found that there had been no direction to accelerate under the acceleration regime. So the third one got knocked out, essentially. But the other two were successful. So the judge found that recovery was permitted in one of two ways, either as damages for breach, essentially, or as costs in mitigating flowing from a breach in terms of the failure to act independently. So This, to me, again, is the other big takeout from the case in terms of the consequences that can flow from a superintendent's lack of independence. So this is not just an issue of credibility or opening up a claim for, you know, review by an arbitral tribunal or a court. These are the consequences that can flow for a principal where the superintendent fails to act independently. In terms of sort of having a think about, is there a way on the front-end side where you could sort of minimise this risk? I haven't actually seen any drafting on this issue yet, but just thinking out loud, you know, perhaps you could have a standalone exclusion clause saying that there won't be a liability for acceleration costs where a claim is rejected by the super. Perhaps you could have a sort of sole entitlement drafting in your EOT and delay damages provisions or something like that. Maybe you go for an indemnity as against the superintendent under the project management agreement for failing to do their job properly. These are just ideas, and I'm not suggesting it's straightforward, and perhaps you probably get pushback as well, but those are the lessons learned on the acceleration claim for me. All right, my personal favourite, talk about early works EOT. It may be a section a little bit confined to its facts, so I won't sort of dwell on it too long. To me, it really just is an example of the consequences of poor drafting when dealing with the interface between the early works and the main works. Our DNC contract contained quite an unusual bespoke provision, Clause 9A, which I've set out in full there. The main point here is that ProBuild's program for the main work assumed that there will be no overlap between the completion of the early works and the start of the main works. And so because of that, the parties included this clause, which said basically, to the extent that early works goes beyond the 7th of October 2011, the dates for practical completion shall be extended. So you probably, the interest is getting peaked in terms of we're not really sort of referring to any claims being delivered. We're not referring to Clause 34 or the main EOT regime. So we just sort of seem to be having this automatic entitlement. And that was just what ProBuild argued. ProBuild was heavily delayed by the early works. I mentioned the poor ground conditions earlier. So that was a real, getting out of the ground was a real problem for ProBuild on this project. Interestingly, during the job, what occurred was that ProBuild actually only submitted EOTs on the basis that it finished the early works in January 2012. So still not too bad. So we've still got an EOT there, and that claim was awarded in full. But once the lawyers got involved during the proceeding, ProBuild alleged for the first time that the early works was not in fact finished until July 2012. So we essentially saw an additional 6 months or so EOT out of the gate. Really, the dispute turned on what does early works completion actually mean, and that would then determine what ProBuild's rights were arising out of Clause 9A. Early works was defined to be quite expansive and included the performance of authority works. ProBuild's argument was Clause 9A means we get an automatic day-for-day extension. It doesn't depend on us submitting a claim, and we didn't. It doesn't depend on whether we actually commenced the work, which we had. So we were sort of getting a bit of a windfall in a way, but we already commenced the work, but yet we were saying the early works are still going and the dates just kept ticking over. And lastly, we don't need to demonstrate any critical delay or any of the other requirements of Clause 34. We just get a day-for-day extension. And we said the only thing you have to do, Your Honour, is figure out when early works completion was achieved. And our argument was, we found some evidence of some power pole relocations that happened in July 2012. We said, ha-ha, that's authority works, and therefore we want a day-for-day extension to give us essentially an additional 6 months. And to our surprise, actually, the judge agreed with that. We thought he'd probably take more of you weren't really critically delayed, and, you know, it's as a matter of fairness, I'm not going to... he found a reason not to allow the claim, but he allowed the claim 100%. So just a little, I think it's not a bad little war story, I suppose, in terms of getting your drafting right. I'm not sure whether I would ever have two separate EOT regimes. So certainly if you're going to have an EOT regime linked to early works, I don't see why you would ever not have it linked to the main EOT regime. and you know the criteria for getting up on an AOT being linked to that. And the other lesson is for me is that you know the technical lawyers claims can get up sometimes, which is always nice. All right, now I'm going to move on now to talk about the programming expert evidence, probably the most technical part, but deals with types of delay analysis, which has certainly been a hot topic recently. Firstly, we'll go through the summary of who gave evidence and what evidence they gave, essentially. On Probood's side, you had James Lyle from HKA, who's now moved on to Lyle Hanson. He preferred a retrospective delay methodology and used an as-planned versus as-built windows analysis. V601 engaged Steve Abbott of SJA, who preferred a prospective delay methodology and utilised a time impact analysis for most of the claims. I think there was a minor difference with one of them. Just to hedge our bets, Probood decided in reply evidence, well, if you're right about prospective, that it being a prospective delay analysis, well, we'll put on our alternative prospective delay analysis in reply. For those of you who don't know, prospective delay analysis, if it sounds like I'm talking a different language, this is a delay analysis which is dealt with or measured at the time of the delaying event. So the programs will probably laugh at me for this explanation, but the programs essentially get impacted at the time of the delay, and it sort of models an outcome or a delay, an EOT entitlement based on that. It's traditionally a contractor-friendly method of analysis because it can result in a greater EOT entitlement than actual delay encountered by the contractor. Doesn't account for mitigation and resequencing and things like that. Retrospective analyses, on the other hand, adopts the perspective evident at the end of the job, accounts for what actually happened, the mitigation that the contractor actually deployed and resequencing, and is therefore traditionally the more principal-friendly form of measuring delays. But in this case, funnily enough, we had a contractor arguing for a retrospective form of analysis, and we had a principal arguing for prospective. So a little bit unusual there. This is Clause 34, or just a summary of the key bits of Clause 34 of the precinct contract. The first bit I wanted to take you to was the entitlement provision, which said, had the common words, Probood is entitled to an EOT where it is or will be delayed in reaching practical completion by a qualifying cause of delay. We might be familiar with the case of Wiggins Island, and I think maybe Built, a recent Queensland case as well, dealing with that phrase. But that phrase has been held to mean that is or will be essentially give the contractor the option of making an EOT claim using a prospective or a retrospective delay methodology. Next part of the regime is the assessment criteria. So this is how the super has to assess the claims. And the relevant bits are, firstly, that the delay must have affected an activity on the critical path of the approved contractor's program at the time of the delaying event. So this part, the delay has affected, suggests past tense, suggests retrospective. But then it sort of undoes it a little bit at the end because it says at the time of the delaying event, which might suggest that it's a prospective form of analysis. Secondly, here, Probood must take all reasonable measures to preclude the cause of delay and to minimise the delay. And so when we're talking about mitigation, of course, that's something that has to be considered after the event occurs. So that suggests a retrospective form of analysis as well. And lastly, that the assessment or the time frame within which the claims are to be assessed was 10 business days after the claim is submitted. Now, that suggests a prospective form of analysis. We're assessing the claim at the time of the claim. So all very confusing. Probood hedged its bets, as I said, and said, well, you can do either, but we think now retrospective is the best because we are measuring actual delay. V601 pinned its bet or put the house on prospective only. No evidence of retrospective delay by V601's expert. And the judge said that he preferred the retrospective analysis. And he really did focus on this part here, the phrase, the delay has affected. He said that could only be mean that the measurement or the EOT assessment must be done on a retrospective basis. He also made some observations around why he preferred retrospective analysis generally. Said that it was more practical, accurate and sensible. and has the benefit of hindsight and utilises as-built facts, whereas prospective is much more theoretical, inferior and less accurate. So we've resolved what the delay methodology is. Unfortunately, that wasn't the only sort of threshold issue that we needed to deal with in the programming expert evidence. The next question was, what is the approved contractors program? It almost became a bit of a comedy during the proceeding, trying to figure out what is the approved contractors program. But what occurred on this job is the superintendent never approved one. You might remember that EOT claims are to be assessed against the approved contractors program. So super never approved one, and in fact there was this dance that often happens where the contractor says, here's my program for approval, and the super rejects it every month, and you sort of never have an approved program. But the contract program was approved, but there was no electronic version of it. We only had a rolled up hard copy version of the program, which couldn't really be used to measure delay at all. So each expert then just picked one. Picked one of the early programs and said, I think this is the approved contractors program. If I make these adjustments to the program, off I go. But V601 ran an argument to say that all of our expert evidence on programming should be knocked out because our expert didn't choose the approved contractors program and therefore the entirety of our evidence sort of falls away. ProBuild ran an interesting argument. I would have loved if this actually had have got up, but we argued that, well, it must be that there is no approved contractors program then. And if that's the case, then the prevention principle's been engaged. We can't have our EOT claims assessed against an approved contractors program if there isn't one. That one didn't succeed, but we didn't really need it in any event, given the LD's findings of the judge. But the court found, or Justice Tibby found, that he did find that the super hadn't acted independently on the program side of things, but that was probably a little bit of a sideshow compared to the other conduct of the super. But he was at pains to keep the EOT regime intact, so the prevention principle wasn't accepted. He just really looked at what the parties intended and decided that ProBuild really just needed to show critical delay by a qualifying cause of delay, so pretty simple. He wasn't interested in technical arguments as opposed to the early works EOT. And he agreed with Lyle's position about the contract program being out of date. So in terms of the summary, ProBuild's expert was preferred. Various findings were made against V601's programming expert, which I think none of them would be unique to this case, but I think that it's not a bad little reminder in terms of the do's and don'ts for our experts. So the judge found that V601's expert made conclusions that weren't based on the evidence, that he purported to interpret the contract, that he strayed outside his area of expertise by starting to make or give an opinion in regard to what mitigation ProBuild could have deployed. So he was sort of putting on his project manager hat, in a sense, to sort of say, well, this is how you should have dealt with it. He gave evidence on matters which weren't pleaded. He was seen to advocate for V601. And the last two sort of came out during the cross-examination. It was revealed that he'd failed to disclose all of his instructions, all the materials briefed to him, and didn't identify the facts and assumptions that were being relied on. So not great reading for V601's expert there. And that was really the reason why, one of the reasons why ProBuild's expert was preferred. So in terms of takeaways for me, I think V601 and the build case, it seems to me that there's a pretty clear trend now in terms of the courts preferring the use of retrospective forms of delay analysis. And if there's a choice between the two, you would expect them to go for retrospective. Obviously, disputes aren't resolved in court until months or years after the conclusion of the project. The facts are known. So I would expect a judge to focus on what the actual delay was rather than a theoretical delay through a prospective analysis. Not to say contractors can't submit claims with prospective analyses, but just how I think a court's going to look at it. Secondly, I think this is an example of the courts, the prevention principle, as much as we love it, or I love it, is rarely engaged, and this is another example of that. to my mind, thirdly, I've never been a fan of ERT regimes where delays are measured against an approved program or a program. Whilst it didn't really matter in this case, it relies on post-contractual conduct, it relies on the parties doing the right thing and the super approving programs. And the program may also bear little relationship or not correlate with what's actually going on the job. So I certainly wouldn't confine the assessment role by reference to a program. I would sort of, give the super the freedom to decide how to assess critical delay, I suppose. And lastly, this is an obvious one. We've all got to ensure that experts properly disclose their instructions and the materials briefed. Delay damages. The main point I wanted to go through with you in this part, this is the last section. Just a couple of interesting arguments that came up in this case around how do we go about apportioning delay damages where a contractor is critically delayed in one separate proportion but not another. And there were some technical legal arguments that were run in the first place. ProBuild, in fact, argued that there is no apportionment. So if ProBuild is delayed in one separable portion, but not in all the other ones, ProBuild ran the argument that this clause 34.9 is drafted such as to entitle us to essentially our costs that we incurred on that day that were time-related costs. So clause 34.9 talked about for every working day, the subject of an ERT, no reference to separable portions, ProBuild was entitled to reasonable and necessarily incurred direct site time-related costs. There were daily aggregate caps on delay damages, but these were in the main part of an extra part A. They weren't in the separable portion part of an extra part A. Another point that ProBuild said, well, this means we don't need to apportion at all. And the clause said nothing about separable portions. So a fairly technical argument, probably never likely to succeed, really. So in the event that we didn't get up on our argument that there was to be no apportionment, we put on some expert evidence from our quantum expert, Mr. Cox, about how that would be done. There was no guidance in the contract as to how apportionment of delay damages was to occur. It was really us or each party asking their expert, how would you go about it? And the judge then sort of making up his mind, essentially. The judge found that apportionment, not surprisingly, that apportionment was required. And so the question then arose, how do we do that? If we only have one separable portion in delay, how do we account for that? You know, we can't cut a project manager into seven pieces. And this slide explains very, very brief summary of how they went about it. What V601's expert advocated for was essentially only where a delay on a separable portion results in an overall delay to the project, that's the only time when you can get delay damages, essentially. So the argument really being those supervisors would have always been on the site even if a separable portion is delayed. If it doesn't delay the overall project, then you haven't really incurred an additional cost. So given that approach, V601's expert didn't go to the trouble of putting forward an apportionment formula. ProBuild took a different view. They argued, essentially, Mr. Cox split out the cost that we incurred into four separate heads of claim: labour, supervision, cranes and hoists, and balance of preliminaries. And then he approached them all slightly differently, quite cleverly, I think. Labour and supervision were dealt with. He essentially calculated the value of the separable portion as a percentage of the entire contract sum, and then multiplied that percentage by whatever our daily costs for labour and supervision were on that particular day. Slightly different for supervision, but the same premise. In terms of cranes and hoists, he decided that he allocated them to the biggest buildings, and he did that because he rationalised that those cranes and hoists couldn't be demobilised until work on those buildings had been sufficiently progressed, so they had to stay regardless of whether there'd been delays on other SPs. So he sort of pinned it on those two buildings and said it might be that this is a... It should correct itself. You know, if I've underestimated on one simple proportion, then this should account for that. And lastly, the balance of preliminaries, Mr. Cox took the same approach as V601's expert. So essentially said, this is the site sheds, the BG fees, the insurance fees, all those sorts of things. That was dealt with on the basis of the extension to the project premise. So if the only claimable where the overall project gets extended. So I thought that was a really interesting way of going about it. I'm not sure whether there are any cases talking about how this is done, but this is how practically the experts did it in this case. Justice did be accepted, Mr. Cox's evidence. He found that B601's evidence, again, a few criticisms of him, failed to include his calculations or his backup workings in his quantum expert report, which made the evidence much less transparent and less persuasive. He also preferred Probuild's approach in terms of trying to work out what costs you incur during the period of delay rather than costs you incur at the end of the job. Another point I wanted to pull out was he looked quite closely at the experience of each of the experts as well, and preferred Probuild's expert who had more of the practical hands-on experience as opposed to B601's expert who was considered to have more what he called academic experience. And lastly, similarly to the programming expert, he made assumptions that were not substantiated and did not have instructions and were not based on any evidence. So just a few issues there as well. I think that's it.